Welcome to LAGIC Step 2. We've got Jerome Nyson here and Peter Baker as well. Jerome's a director in Deloitte's Risk Services line dedicated to providing risk transformation and internal audit advice to insurance sector clients. Jerome has 15 years of industry experience and consulting experience with either global financial services institutions or big four consultants in the UK and Asia. A key focus of Jerome's has been providing advice to global insurance firms on approaches to integrating risk and capital management and embedding these frameworks into decision making. Jerome's industry experience is further supported as a Master's in Risk Management. Peter's an Associate Director in Deloitte's Actuaries and Consultants and been working in the life insurance industry since 2005. He's got extensive knowledge in financial modelling, including capital. He's led the implementation of a number of LAGIC and target surplus models within the life insurance companies in Australia over the past few years, and has also worked on a Solvency II implementation in Asia, focusing on Pillar 2 development. So, welcome Jerome and Peter, without further ado.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? That's yes. Firstly, appreciate there's quite a few concurrent presentations going on at the moment. So thank you for choosing Peter and I's presentation. Thank you for your time today. And thanks to the Chair for your kind introduction. Before we kick off today, I wanted a little bit of audience participation. And so if I could ask you to raise your hands to some of the questions that I'm about to ask, and I'll sort of point you in a sort of a yes or no direction with some of these. So out of the audience members here, who believes that the pace of change of risk and capital management regulations for Australian insurers is likely to increase in the next 5 years more compared to the last 5 years? So you think pace is going to increase, please lift up your hands. There you are. That's actually looking like a minority. Who thinks the pace is going to decrease? Okay, so the pace of change is going to decrease in terms of capital management regulations. Now, in terms of next question, which, for the organisations you represent, which of you are just solely regulated by APRA, or do you actually have requirements set upon you by other supervisors in other jurisdictions? So who is solely regulated by APRA in this room? Hands up. Okay, and organisations who are regulated by other jurisdictions? Okay, so that's interesting to see. Fantastic. So we've got a majority who have influence from regulations in jurisdictions outside of Australia. Finally, for the organisations that that actually regulated by supervisors outside of Australia, who actually believes that, who actually performs a formal assessment of the benefits of those individual capital and risk management regulations. So which organisations actually perform a formal assessment of those risk and capital management regulations before your organisation embarks on that change program? So yes for a formal benefit analysis, and hands up. And no, if you don't perform a formal cost-benefit analysis before you embark on the capital and risk management regulation. So that's a majority of participants. And you know, that's probably pretty reflective of the Australian insurance industry population, certainly in my experience. And it actually drives Peter to the purpose of this presentation, which is, we would like to actually be guiding our insurance clients towards a more proactive position on actually having a regulatory risk register, looking at the emerging regulatory trends and actually assessing the benefits of those changes that are coming, being driven by regulation, the risk and capital management regulation. Our abstract here is that we believe that there is going to be a lot more benefit gained in the long term for organisations that do this on a proactive basis. With that purpose in mind, we've structured our session along the three table of contents areas here. Firstly, we'd like to perform a very quick stock take of the regulatory journey that we've been on locally and internationally, and certainly not going to do as good a job as Rob has done earlier on today, but we'll certainly touch on that, particularly the salient points for this presentation. We're going to identify some of the challenges which organisations told Deloitte they were facing during 2012 when a survey was performed, and actually we're going to reflect on how organisations are actually progressing against those challenges. We're going to look at some of the benefits that organisations can actually receive from putting further investment into those particular areas of focus. And then we're just going to touch base and reflect on the future direction of travel of risk and capital management regulation within Australia and look at what it's going to mean for the audience here. And at this point, I'll hand over to Peter to touch on our introduction.
Yeah, thanks, Jerome. So I'm just going to briefly kick off the introduction and I guess our overview of what's happened in the market so far the last few years. So I guess internationally we've seen a lot of change and a lot of growth in the amount of regulation that's been hitting the insurance industry in particular. We've seen regulators who are becoming more aligned with international standards. So I guess historically APRA has been had a look at what's been happening abroad, Solvency II, what's happening in the US, how the Asian companies, regulators are changing, and has fed that into the designs of how the regulation works in Australia. What we're seeing, or what we think is happening and will happen more over the next few years, is that there's going to be more alignment of the standards worldwide. So we've had a few changes over the last few years, such as the IIS reporting up to the FSB. And so with the creation, they've been tasked with creating a new insurance capital standard. And APRA, being a key participant in the IIS, is expected to adopt some of those principles in their own local requirements. So I think rather than what we've seen in the past, where we've seen, say, APRA having a look at, say, or what's happening in Solvency II, taking a similar framework and applying it in Australia, we may be quite likely to see much more closer alignment with these international regulations. The way that LAGIC worked in Australia was probably that we were fortunate enough, or APRA was fortunate enough, to have the beginnings of Solvency II framework that were in place in Europe. They were able to structure LAGIC off that. And in fact, because of the way that it was implemented, we actually even had it implemented before Solvency II has been implemented in Europe. But we expect that alignment is only going to strengthen going forwards.
So with the benefits Australia then received by having LAGIC in place, both from a Pillar 1 and some of the benefits associated with even Pillar 2 and associated with implementing some of the prudential standards, Australia's been on the front foot. What we're now looking at with this onset of, a new raft of risk and capital management standards being implemented is that the sands are starting to shift again. Again, coming back to the importance of organisations having that regulatory risk radar and actually proactively identifying, assessing regulations for the benefits that they could actually hold for the organisation, but also appreciating where they're actually likely to have challenges, knowing the capability of the people, their processes and systems. There's also a lot of benefits that can be held by taking a long-term view of these. You know, I draw upon those 8 years in the UK where I worked on multiple Solvency II projects. And, it was very clear that, if I take a good example, very clear working with the organisation like Prudential, where they, at the very onset of the Solvency II program, they identified the areas where they saw the most value, the areas whereby they were going to embed the internal model into decision-making processes, into strategic planning, where they were going to use it for mergers and acquisition-type decisions. Benefits around engaging the board. They defined those areas of value up front and, as a result, prioritised the investment into those areas. And it actually created a much stronger, more positive sentiment within the program, and it made it much easier for the program to actually engage with business stakeholders when it comes to actually implementing those change programs. So, with that broad introduction in mind, wouldn't mind just sort of touching base for just a couple of minutes on what has been the regulatory journey that we've been on. And again, others today have talked more in depth about some of the specific regulatory developments that have gone before us and are coming in front of us. But it's worthwhile just recapping and looking at the challenge that was presented within Europe, within Solvency II, looking at how that was compounded by the global financial crisis, and the impact that that had on the insurance industry and the way the insurance industry was then regulated. The FSB took on greater responsibility for IAIS, and as a result of that, they were instructed to create the ICS and actually install quite a vast array of additional capital requirements on global insurers. In addition, there was an introduction of the GSI requirements, which obviously applied to those top 9 globally systemically important insurers. That 2013 point was a real turning point for the insurance industry. And what we can see is a lot of themes emerging from this point that are reflected here in the Australian environment. We've seen a greater focus internationally on more risk-based and risk-sensitive capital calculation methodologies. We've seen a much greater focus on engagement with the board, clearer definition of the role of the board and its subcommittees, a greater role to be played by the risk function and the CRO. We've seen a huge focus on the integration of risk and capital management into decision-making processes, with regulators actually focusing their attention, their interventions with senior management around starting with, talk me through how risk and capital managers embed into your decisions and walk backwards into what is your policies and systems in place. Finally, an increased supervision spend. We're seeing regulators internationally having larger budgets around the supervision of organisations, particularly the systemically important ones. The outlook looking forward is tied into the ICS, potentially an additional Solvency III. Who knows what's going to happen when the regulations, IAIS requirements bite in Europe. Who knows what's going to happen in the future around the globally systemically important requirements, whether the methodology gets expanded and encapsulates more than 9 organisations, potentially reinsurers. It's probably fair to say that there's more that we don't know what's coming around the corner in terms of what we actually do know.
Yeah. Thanks. Just before we move on as well, I guess it's worth pointing out that I guess where we want to go with this presentation is around the regulation in Australia. Is everybody's complying with the regulation at the moment to varying degrees, and what we are interested in looking at is is there any benefit of pre-adopting what might come in the future, and where can we look to seize that type of thing? So what we're going to go through later on in our presentation is some of the benefits you can get out of some of the risk management things that are coming out of these frameworks. So to give a brief background again of what's been happening in Australia, as a refresher, LAGIC's structure for LAGIC, APRA's structure for LAGIC follows a very similar structure to Solvency II, which has a three-pillar structure. So the first pillar being essentially the calculations. Second one being the qualitative and supervision requirements, so and that including all the risk management pieces, and then pillar three being the essentially disclosure. So what's happened in Australia over the last few years? Well, we've got pillar one down pat really. All those came in at the beginning of 2013. There's still clearly a number of areas where companies are still struggling to streamline the processes. So one of them being that companies are seeing a lot more volatility in the capital versus the previous standards. And what we see is that companies are trying to find new ways of presenting their capital and reducing that volatility. So that is potentially somewhere where we can draw on some of the things that people have been doing as part of Solvency II. So because of the complex nature of the stochastic models required for that, a lot of companies have started to look at using light models. And so essentially that's a proxy model, some type of regression where you fit essentially factors and that gives you an estimate of your capital. And we've seen companies starting to think about using that in Australia. So even though we're not using these stochastic requirements, at least we can use that to help forecast our capital better in Australia. The second thing is around stakeholders, that particularly with this high volatility, that people are still struggling to relate the changes in capital to what is actually happening in the business. And that is something that will just naturally improve over time. And thirdly, that companies still need still a lot of places where there are manual calculations being done, spreadsheets that do this and that, and companies are looking to put those into their mainstream models and make it BAU. So overall, pillar one is getting there. There's a bit more work that will be done over the next year or so, just in time for the next lot of regulation, no doubt. Pillar two. There's been a lot of work that's happened post the implementation of LAGIC in 2013. So we've seen, for example, the introduction of the new risk management standards, of the new requirements of having an independent CRO, and new requirements around things like data quality and risk management. All of those, I guess, we can expect to have further scrutiny from APRA and further development by APRA over the next couple of years. These are some of the areas where I think we could expect that if you were to spend some time improving beyond just the compliance roles, compliance obligations of the current regulation, you can actually get some benefit out of it and also effectively be an early adopter of what is to come in the future. Then there's pillar three. There's not that much to say about that, except that there's probably still a few companies having difficult or streamlining the reporting of the new APRA statistics. And of course, APRA itself had that review of the data confidentiality back in 2013. So now you can get data available effectively at a company level. I think it's at an institutional level at the moment. So greater granularity of data that's available in the market. So what we want to do is really be focusing around the pillar two pieces in this presentation. With that, I'll hand back to Jerome, who's going to go through the next piece.
So herein lies the challenge of investing wisely. In pulling together the presentation, we looked back at a survey that Deloitte performed in Australia in 2012. The survey with population was of about 50 Australian insurers, and it actually asked what are the key areas of focus or the challenges that insurers were having around implementing the LAGIC framework and other related prudential standards. You can see here an ordering of those, and that's encapsulated by the table in blue. And since the introduction of that survey, Peter and I have actually done some work more recently to go back and actually look at the comments being made by Australian and international regulators to identify where the future direction of regulation is looking to go and try and compare it back to those areas of challenge and actually perform a subjective assessment of terms of the areas where organisations might receive benefit from actually in further investing in these areas. And what our expectation is that there's a real opportunity for Australian insurers to be building tables like this when it comes to facing big regulatory changes. When the ICS comes into play in Australia in whatever shape or form, if further globally systemic insurance requirements comes into play, again, there's an opportunity to break down the regulation, look at the benefits that the organisation can have from those subparts, look at the future direction, and really invest where those international standards are going to push upwards, and you're going to get the most medium-term return from that investment. What we'd like to do is actually take some of those areas and just drill into those a little bit more. In particular, we'd like to talk about risk appetite to start off with. Risk appetite can theoretically have a lot of benefit for Australian insurers. From our experience, most insurers actually struggle to get beyond the theory and actually truly embed this. We've been working with a number of insurers lately on building risk appetite statements and working out how to build it. And I'd like to share an example with you whereby we actually got the best bang for the insurer's buck in the first year of implementation. We actually looked at an ideal risk appetite statement in a full maturity, and we identified that they didn't have the budget to actually build that capability over a 12-month time horizon. What we did identify through discussing their business strategy is that they were looking to embark upon some acquisitions over the coming 12 to 18 months. So that we decided, instead of focusing on actually building out some of the insurance and investment risk limits frameworks supporting the risk appetite statement, it was going to be more beneficial to the board to support them if we actually focused on some of their key performance measures and understanding the tolerability the board was comfortable with for those key performance measures. So we identified the benefit that they would actually retain from actually investing further in a risk appetite statement. We prioritised that area, and then we created a three-year program for actually building out and fleshing out the risk appetite statement. There's other benefits from actually investing in risk appetite, and it's certainly an area of regulatory focus. Putting in place a strong risk appetite statement that's clearly communicated and reinforced by decisions in the business can have a big influence on an organisation's risk culture, something which our boards are struggling to define and influence within the Australian community. It also has a big impact on the risk orientation of the organisation's leaders, particularly if you're actually tying risk appetite statements to the performance measures which those same leaders are actually being measured upon. Articulating risk appetite statements and having clear limits can actually increase the dynamic nature of the organisation in the way in which the organisation or the management can actually make decisions within a framework set by the board. It also can result in more clear and more efficient communication between management in the board, as you can very clearly attach some delegations of authority from the risk appetite statement, from the board down to management. There are also some key challenges in establishing a risk appetite framework. Too often, organisations get stuck in the detail and get focused on a risk-by-risk analysis and actually setting detailed limits on a bottom-up basis within risk appetite statements. I'd recommend if you, to start off with, you're better off potentially starting with on a top-down basis. Again, reinforcing the point of also include not just your material risks within your risk appetite statement, but include the performance measures that the organisation is currently managing its organisation to and monitoring the performance of its leadership. Too often I see risk appetite statements which are worded in a language which is probably appropriate for a regulator, but not necessarily reflective of the language that the organisation uses. So again, looking to articulate your risk appetite statement in the organisation's own language. Second area of focus will be around scenario analysis and stress modelling.
Yeah, so I think this fits hand in hand with the risk appetite statement. Jerome's spoken a bit about how it needs to be practical and that, and this is exactly one of the ways that you can do that. So by using scenarios, you know, you can make it more tangible to those, particularly those who are not down into the numbers. So you'd probably all be aware that this was already introduced as part of the ICAP report, and that companies have been developing this over the last few years. Clearly there are benefits to doing more rather than less scenario testing, and you know, not in the least being prepared for these adverse scenarios, but also about really improving the engagement, the tangibility with which the board and the senior management see risk. And I think that's one of the key things that is useful. This is one of the key tools that can be used to help senior management change risk culture. I think it's one of the areas where some people cannot see or don't see risk management in a tangible way, and therefore when they I guess that reflects in the way that they treat it within the business. So giving it a tangibility means that people see the relevance of it and much more likely to incorporate it and use it in their business. So there's a few key challenges to overcome in terms of getting a good quality, I guess, scenario and stress modelling process going. One of them is what we termed groupthink, which is the idea that, I guess, organisations tend to attract people, continue to attract people who have a similar mindset. And so over time you get people in senior management who are thinking in the same way. And so one of the struggles, or one of the things you need to make sure when you're setting up these sessions is to make sure you've got a broad enough range of people attending your session that you think outside the box and have a real a good quality brainstorm. One of the other things is just obviously making sure that these scenarios and stresses that you choose actually turn out to be something that is tangible and makes sense to those people as being something that is adverse but not something that's so... but not so much so that it's intangible and difficult to see. So what I wanted to do is just quickly go through a few examples of what we've been doing across a few different clients. The first three are very similar in terms of they're all essentially around testing out scenarios with the business. So it's like a role play. So one thing we did with one of the GI companies was to play what we termed war games, and that we got the board in a room, came up with these scenarios and essentially hit them with them and asked them to say, okay, well, how would you respond to that? So by applying the risk management, the risk appetite framework, making them think about the management actions they would actually apply as these situations unfold. Same thing can be done for across the whole company, right down to the operational level, where you've got people say a fraud issue happens or a unit pricing issue, and it's good to role play those so that managers and key personnel know exactly what to do when these situations arise. Reverse stress testing is also something that's come out people are thinking about that much more in the last couple of years. And this, I guess, for those who are not aware, reverse stress testing is essentially starting off at the most extreme end and saying, okay, what is a scenario that would break the company? And then working backwards from that and understanding what are the implications of various alternate scenarios. We find that to be very, very helpful for companies. I guess one of the things to keep in mind, I suppose, is that scenario testing is all about these adverse scenarios. If we look back across any industry, there's not as many companies that rock the market when times are in boom times, right? You see a lot of companies gaining significant market share when in downturns. So we think it's really useful that companies consider this and think about what strategies they apply when things go wrong, because these are some of the big opportunities that companies have to improve their standing. Jerome, you're going to talk through this.
And then finally, the fourth area we'd like to talk to you about in a bit of a drill down is around engaging the board. And again, this is an increasing area where we're seeing management bringing Deloitte in to assist them to engage the board. They're looking for us to help them to actually engage them around the question is, why are we engaging? So let me start that again. When we start this engagement, when we're supporting management to help them engage the board, we start off by asking them why they want to engage the board and what do they want to achieve from engaging the board, as opposed to how they are going to engage the board. Quite often we'll be requested to come in and run a scenario or actually do a presentation on industry views. But again, coming back to the concept of understanding the benefits of these activities, again, we recommend that you start off by thinking about the why and the what, as opposed to the how to start off with. Again, drawing upon a recent example whereby we ran a scenario exercise with a large life insurance board. We were actually engaged to perform a scenario exercise that, again, would break the business, that would actually challenge the board in terms of its views around its own risk appetite on a capital basis, on a risk basis, looking at everything from financial measures right the way through to risk appetite. When we're having conversations with the CFO, CRO and the Chief Strategy Officer, they all had different views, ranging from trying to actually get a collective view from the board on what the plan B strategy should be, right the way through to the purpose of the exercise being to appease regulatory requirements. Again, having that upfront conversation around what were the benefits of actually doing this exercise had immense value to the process that we then went through. There's a vast array of benefits that can be obtained from engaging the board on risk and capital management. Obtaining that consistent language about how the board wants to actually challenge management's views on investments and in priorities is absolutely key. Also obtaining a clearer direction on the culture that the board wishes to establish, and educating them in the variations, educating the board themselves in the variations in the culture which actually exists across the organisation. Engaging the board also allows you to actually stress test the strategy itself and actually look at the priorities of the organisation, of the board, or the individual members of the board when the business plan is actually under stress. Quite often that can vary and the collective view goes out the window pretty quickly. In addition, to those type of benefits, there are challenges in engaging the board. Making it real is of primary importance. Setting up scenarios that actually use real life events that's been experienced within the industry, using numbers, co-presenting with management, again, increases how real these scenarios can be, and actually gets a much better realistic response from the board. Challenges exist around obtaining a collective view from the board. Too often the board is perceived as a single vessel, but the reality being that each of the individual members of the board have their own views and will, when under stress, will actually express those views quite differently. Running these types of scenarios in these sessions, having these conversations, can help tease out that variation in view and actually help focus it on a single statement, like a risk appetite statement. Challenges exist around keeping them out of the detail. Whilst they've got increasing responsibilities and you want to present more and more information, educate them more on the capital calculations, give them more and more risk information, keeping them out of the detail continues to be a challenge. Okay.
Okay. So the last one I wanted to cover was around data quality and risk management. So I think most people are aware of the benefits that data can provide, and I think you need to think not only around the compliance requirements but also of those benefits to the business. So, for example, from data mining, being able to target particular customers, being able to sell, look at price, and the prices that customers are willing to pay. So you don't have to look very far to find quite a lot of examples, not only in the insurance market, of where data is being used quite well. And so data quality and the management of that data is paramount. So regardless of what the current standards are, there's significant benefit of going beyond what are the current requirements. I don't know how many of you have read about about what happened in Target in the US a couple of years ago, and essentially what happened there is that they obviously collect a whole lot of data from there, similar to what Woolies do in Australia, where everybody has a card, and when you go and purchase stuff, they have a record of what you've bought. And so essentially they brought in a whole lot of statisticians to come in and say, okay, well, great, like, how can we use this data to target customers better? And one of the statisticians said, okay, great, let's have a look at how we can predict pregnancy. And so they said, okay, well, great, if we look at, they worked out that there was a basket of 25 different products, and if they focused on those products, they could predict pregnancy to within 87% probability, which is obviously quite high. And so there was a story in I think it was Minneapolis or something, about a father who came in angrily to this store and said, how come you're sending all these ads about cots and nappies to my daughter? Are you trying to get her pregnant or something, encouraging her to get pregnant? And the store manager was like, yeah, sorry, profusely apologizing. And then a few days later, they followed up with a phone call to apologize and, you know, formally close off the matter. And the father's sheepishly saying, well, it seems like there were some matters that I didn't know about in my household. I should be the one apologizing to you. My daughter is due in 6 months. And so I guess, like, out of that, it's scary to see what benefits, we can get out of data and insights we can see. So one of the things that I wanted to draw on was, I guess, what has happened as part of Solvency II in terms of data quality. How can we improve data quality and the management around that data to make sure that we've got a solid base to use for both compliance and use within the company? So when I was working on a project for one of the global insurers, we had a process of going through and meeting the data quality requirements. That started off with defining the data itself. So under Solvency II regulation, it's actually a little bit less clear about what exactly data actually is defined as. So you can imagine the process of having raw data, which, say, goes into assumption setting, it goes into models. Then coming out of the models, there will be results that go into your reporting spreadsheets that then go into other management information, go into your financial reports and things. And so at each point along the way, there's data flows between the steps. And do you cover that and classify that as data, or do you treat it separately? Now, under Solvency II, that's not quite so clear. What we ended up doing for the company I was working with was that we didn't treat it, those intermediate steps, as data, but actually covered it under a separate process and just had the original raw inputs as data. Now, under APRA, my reading of the rules say that data covers those intermediate steps, because it says it covers both structured and unstructured, entered, calculated and derived. So I would say, for example, data coming out of a calculation that goes into reporting would therefore be data and is covered by these risk management requirements. So then after that, there's a process of process mapping, identifying the gaps and closing those gaps and the regular management. I think the key thing to point out is that you want to, when you're doing the process mapping, you want to make sure that you're gathering enough information so that when you identify gaps, you can then assign those to owners and exactly work out exactly what needs to be closed off and who's going to do it. The ongoing governance, I guess, needs to cover the risk management as well as the processes for what's going to happen if there is an issue. And who's going to fix it, in what time frame, etc. So what we have is that at the end of the day, we've got a data quality process, set of guidelines and a risk management process, which you can use to clearly say yes or sign off on your data and be able to say yes, my data is good enough quality to use. And so one of the things that we needed to focus on was to make sure that there was a materiality element into that. So at what point do you say there is an error with data? There's data errors everywhere. What are you going to classify and follow up on? And so setting a limit, usually quantitative-wise, is very important. Yes, yeah. So that's all I wanted to say on that. Do you want to flick through to the next slide? So we wanted to wrap up there and say, okay, well, what do we see going forwards? Well, some of our colleagues in Europe did a survey where they went around and spoke to insurers in Europe and Asia, and clearly those respondents said that they expect significant change going forwards. And I guess we, as we said earlier on in our presentation, we've got more, we can expect more alignment with global standards going forwards. So some of the developments that have happened at IIAS, and indeed those that are happening in Solvency II, we should think about and understand, there are some that we should be early adopting, particularly those that give us benefit in the short term, and short term and the medium term. That's all I wanted to say. Did you want to say some more words there?
No, that's about it. That's probably just wrapping up.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, we've got just a couple of minutes for some questions, so it's probably a good time to throw it open to the floor. And if you can assist the room by using the microphone in the middle there and ask these lads a question.
Brett Pickett, what do you believe? How do you believe APRA could improve the risk-based regime? Which part of, say, the risk-based regime do you believe is less than ideal, or could be enhanced significantly?
In terms of calculation,
I think it's okay. I think it's more the.
It could be all
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. So I would have seen the biggest opportunity in terms of. Embedding the calculations in the business. So I think getting the board and the senior management showing them more tangible examples of risk management, which helps them to implement it properly within the business. It's a very difficult thing to do, of course, that's probably the biggest area where that could be changed.
Possibly around some of the experience around the used test requirements coming out of Solvency 2. There was requirements for people who effectively run the firm to actually understand the design of the internal model, the assumptions that go into the internal model, and be able to demonstrate that the internal model would actually improve as a result of the use of the internal model. That those kind of principles, could, whilst internal models aren't favoured by APRA, those type of principles could certainly be applied within the domestic market.
Any further questions?
Probably a bit more of a comment than a question, but it's interesting because when ICAAP and LAGIC were introduced in Australia, the same as when ORSA was introduced in the UK, I think lots of companies had ambitions as to what they wanted to do, and as the deadline for having to actually meet a black letter compliance standard got closer and closer, those ambitions were shelved in order to be able to put a tick against everything that APRA needed as at the 31st of December 2012 so that you could enter the new regime saying you were compliant. Then all the big projects wound down, and so now you're looking at sort of improvements which are currently being made, sort of being made within a bare U environment. So the changes that I see currently being made are more in the nature of, I guess, cementing existing processes. So as you said, sort of taking a fairly manual spreadsheet which doesn't have the best controls in it and putting more controls around it rather than actually making a leap forward in sophistication. It's interesting to see how that next leap forward in sophistication will come with the competing spend for what is ultimately seen by management often as a compliance spend, given that we've got Trowbridge, we've had issues with advisors. There's lots of issues at the moment which are competing for that compliance dollar spend. So trying to get that impetus to, I guess, get companies to think about spending on the risk cultures, get spending on improvements in capital forecasting, et cetera, that's actually going to be an improvement in sophistication rather than just being a cementing of existing process. That's, I think, is the challenge for us.
I think we'd agree with that. You know, if I take a lesson learned from time in the UK, the FSA's ARROW regulatory supervision approach used to start with interviews that would be focused on, tell me about your business plan, tell me about your strategy, key decisions you've made recently, and work backwards from there. And they wanted to see how the regulatory change programs were being put in place and how you're going to comply, how it would affect decisions. And therefore, you know, focus was there more on defining and investing around risk appetite, risk culture, improved understanding of roles and responsibilities, and probably less around, you know, creating more policies and frameworks and documents that might, you know, help you with technical compliance.
Yeah, and just to wrap up as well, my comment on that would be I think that's exactly where things like this data quality come in. So if you can find benefits outside the compliance area, those are obviously things that can help you to push that further development along.
Thank you. Well, we're getting our marching orders, so
thank you very much.
Thank you, Jerome. Thank you, Peter. Give him a round of applause.